All right. So, as the announcements say, we are going to over the course of the next 5-6 weeks, we're going to try to work our way through the theological interpretation of American history. And the reason for this is simply I got this book about 2 months ago because I'd heard it highly recommended as a way to understand how do we get where we're at today. And so I thought, okay, this might be interesting. I got the book, blown me away. It's been enlightening. I think it would be good for us to understand our history. In some ways, it could be a little depressing. In other ways, it can be very hopeful because one of the things, actually, I thought this was great in your question on the BH list the other day with Rich, you know, just this idea that when we look at where we're at today and the big steps we have to overcome, it reminds us of the Reformation and what they had to overcome. I mean, what they had to overcome in battling politics and the Catholic Church. And you think about what they did and how it happened and these little events that happened. You know, it gives you hope. Okay, we can read about our history. We can see how we got here. But we also know that little steps that we're doing, like gathering together and worshiping together and serving one another and fellowshipping, these things matter. And Reformation starts in these little moments. So I think that's what we're doing here. So there is optimism here, for sure. I got two different sheets here. And you can just hold on to them. And we'll get to them in a little bit, if you don't mind passing them out. I made 15 copies, so if we don't have enough, maybe we share. I should have made more, but. And if you want copies, I can always make some more and bring them next week. So, let me begin by quoting somebody, so I found this online. This is somebody that read the book. I think it was probably Amazon, but it was a pastor that I am aware of, I've met before in Louisiana, a Baptist pastor. But he read this book, and this is what he said about it. He said, "History does not proceed without the ideas of men behind it, past, present, and future. Because of this, Greg Singer's book is a must-read for pastors and people to understand the ideas behind our American history. It is surprising to see how much Calvinism and Calvinistic leaders helped guide our country's founding and achieve stability and freedom, especially for religion. The book is also a challenge to teach sound doctrine in the church, to raise up faithful and thinking people to influence the ideas behind our future." Now, the first section of this book, the intro, I think is worth talking about just briefly, and it's simply interpreting history. So we have a book here with a historian interpreting history through a Calvinistic lens. And that's rare. This is very similar to science. You know, science says, oh, well, you can keep your religion over here, but we're unbiased. And we have this unbiased view of science, and religion doesn't have a place in it. Well, historians kind of think that too. You know, they think that they're unbiased when they're studying history, and they much like science, where you just have the data. Oh, we're looking at the data unbiasedly. Well, historians are looking at the data unbiasedly, and then that's where we all laugh because that's not true. They have a definite bias. And what the author here says is this book is born of the conviction that ideas in general do have consequences. And that theological ideas have tremendous consequences in the life of a nation. This is why he wrote the book. You know, historical scholarship should not be just concerned with acquiring the facts, but with correct interpretation of the facts. Even those historians and textbooks that claim to be just presenting the facts without bias show their bias in which facts are presented. So, for instance, how much time is dedicated in an American history textbook to the Puritans, and which key moments are presented as relevant to American history. So you might not have an opinion about religion or the Puritans or certain instances in history, but even just in the way that you present history and what facts you deem important shows your bias. There are different ways to do history. For instance, you could have an environmental view of history, and that would be, you know, some people would trace American history, and they would put a lot of importance on the frontier, or the, you know, when the colonials came and they had to fight Indians and they had to just basically start from scratch and build their own world, and they talk about how important the frontier life was to shaped who we are today, and that is true. There is an element of that. You can talk about history from an economic perspective and how our economy had such a massive impact on the shaping of our history. And again, these things are true. But here's what Greg Singer says. And he says, most historians point to democracy as the heart of American history and the American dream. And a lot of our history, whether it is an economic view, whether it's an environmental view, a lot of our histories go to, you know, Thomas Jefferson, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. This is sort of like the central moment of history, and everything else sort of, you know, revolves around that. But what Greg Singer says is yes, this is important, but there are three important basic questions that historians fail to answer. Number one, why did Jefferson, again, we know that he looked to John Locke. Why did he look to John Locke and the other philosophers of democracy rather than to the Puritan political heritage? Also, why did the founding fathers of 1787 take such elaborate precautions to set up a form of government which would guard against the rise of democracy? And then third, why has the Constitution been increasingly used to promote this same democratic form of government, which it was designed to prevent from gaining a foothold in the new nation? So we can look at the facts and we can see that these things happen. Greg Singer wants to know, why did this happen? What happened before this? The drastic change from a constitutional republic to a democracy is one of the major events of American history. How did this happen? While many historians give credit to the influence of thinkers and philosophers on our founding fathers, for instance, John Locke's writings on and the influence on Thomas Jefferson, very few historians acknowledge the important role that theology has played in the shaping of America. Hence, why we need to begin with the Puritans. Greg Singer says this, "The recognition of the importance of intellectual forces in the stream of history must be followed by one other step, namely, the realization that the intellectual development of a people is not an entity in itself, but in turn depends upon their theology or lack thereof. The great weakness in the major schools of historical interpretation of the present day lies in the fact that they have adopted either humanism or some form of scientific naturalism, evolution, and this, as the source of all the necessary presuppositions for their philosophies of history." Basically, again, what that is saying is what I said earlier, nobody is unbiased. We all have a worldview that we are bringing to our understanding of history. Even the great historians have a bias. And most of these historians, if you go to a bookstore, most books of history are coming from a humanistic or an evolutionary presupposition. So let's get into the Puritans. Let's go back over 100 years from the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Let's go back and see what America looked like when the Puritans came over. Puritanism, the prevailing theological and philosophical system, not only in England, but in most of the colonies founded during the 17th century, is the key which unlocks the meaning of colonial history as a whole. Now, modern assumptions about Puritanism are either completely absurd, or they fall extremely short of what it actually was. I mean, we've all either seen the movie or read the book, the Scarlet Letter, and you know, that's typically what people think of. When they think Puritanism, they think of these uptight, you know, stick in the mud types, you know, that were very solemn, and they're bad. They're typically bad guys in the stories, right? Puritanism was not simply a religion, though, or a set of rules, but was a way of living that brought all spheres of life under the authority of God's word. This includes church, family, and government. The Puritans of New England went there for the express purpose of setting up a commonwealth which would give full expression to that world and life view inherent in their Calvinistic theology. Now, I gave a, what I put out there, one of the things is a timeline of Puritanism. And here's where I'm going to kind of step away from the book a little bit. And because he kind of takes that for granted. The stuff on Puritanism is simply the intro. But we're a Reformed church. So we are in this line of Puritanism and Reformed theology. You know, we're in the year 2020 and we're going back 400 years and trying to understand what happened. And these are our people. In a big way, these are our people. So it's helpful to understand our people, even going back into England. Because the Puritans just didn't show up on American soil and just decide they're going to be Puritans. I mean, that started, you could even say it started beyond England, but we got to start somewhere. So England is a good place to begin. And so I'm not going to go through the whole timeline, but you have a timeline here that sort of hits the highlights of what happened in history. You know, we start with 1509 because Henry VIII became King of England, and that's a good starting point. A lot of these moments you may recognize. Some of them you may not know. If we have time at the end, perhaps we can talk through some of them. But right now, I just want to point out that there's this timeline here, and it's helpful to kind of get a sense of how America came out of this, how the Puritans came out of what was happening in England. And so I may refer to this from time to time here. So let's talk about Puritan theology. Singer says, for the Puritans, the biblical doctrines of God, creation, man, and sin and redemption were not regarded as simple vehicles for the salvation of the individual soul, important as that was, but they spoke to the whole life. God was to be worshipped on the Sabbath and to be reckoned with on the other 6 days of the week as well. The sovereignty of God guided Puritan thought and action. So that's the most important thing about Puritan theology, the sovereignty of God. It drove everything that they believed, not just their theology, not just the way they did things in church, but the way they organized the government, the way they organized their family life, the way they organized their economy, the way they organized business. Everything came under the sphere of God's sovereignty. The doctrine of the fall and the total depravity of man was a massive influence. That's a key issue of their theology, key aspect, I should say. It spoke directly to every aspect of life, their understanding of the fall and sin. Human sin made human government necessary. As a sinner, man is to be educated, and as a sinner, he enters into economic activity and social relationships. And then finally, if we're just going to hit the highlights of Puritan theology, we have sovereignty, we have their doctrine of sin, and then we have their doctrine of redemption. The Puritans recognized the distinctive role of sovereign grace in the redemptive process, and they never expected human political, social, or economic institutions to usurp the place of the church in society or to accomplish for man, either here on earth or in the future life, that salvation would come through the gospel alone. And this is key. We're going to talk about this in a little bit, but maybe I'll just mention it now. This is key to Puritan. This is what set them apart from everybody else. You know, some people call the Puritans hypocrites because here they are battling against the Church of England and the Church of England telling them you must worship this way. And so they come to America and they set up a theocracy that says you must worship this way. But the difference is their understanding of the spheres, like in the sphere that they were coming from the Catholic Church first and then the Church of England, there was no division between theology and politics. So politics was just important to your salvation. That played a role. In Puritan theology, it was different. Politics served what the theology. Politics was there to help create the kingdom of God. It was to assist. There was definitely a division there. So let's talk about Puritan political philosophy. The political conflict in England between the crown and the parliament. Again, you can look at the timeline there. Maybe it'd be helpful here to just run through some stuff. Of course, Henry VIII, one of the things when you talk about the Reformation, and there's a lot of nuance that we just can't get into. I mean, there were some good aspects about Henry VIII. I mean, we think of him as the guy that, you know, killed four of his wives and had six wives. But he also was a very learned man. But there is a sense where his welcoming and embrace of the Reformation was a sense of him wanting to be free of the Catholic Church and setting himself up as his own pope. Having a Church of England and him basically being the head of the church is like him being the pope. And so there was a certain aspect of politics there. Of course, in the history, you have his son, Edward, moved Protestantism on a little bit farther. But then, of course, you have Mary, you know, Bloody Mary came along, enforced Catholicism, murdered 300 Puritans and Protestants. And for 5 years, it was a reign of terror. And then Elizabeth inherits the throne and brings us back, you know, reestablishes Anglicanism, is sympathetic to Protestantism. And, you know, but during that whole time, there's battles. The Catholic Church is still trying to take over. You know, they hate the fact that Protestantism has its own thing going on. And so you have these battles, and the Catholic Church is constantly trying to make things right again by exerting force. And so in history, one of the big turning points is the Spanish Armada is defeated. So Spain, Catholic Spain, is coming to England, and they're going to, by force, make England Catholic again. They're going to take over, make England, because that's what you're supposed to be. They are rebelling against God, and they're rebelling against the crown, but they were defeated. Or technically, I mean, the Spanish Armada was defeated. The war continued for a long time afterwards, but it was a very key moment because that was sort of the moment you can point to where Catholicism was done. It was not going to make inroads into England again. Their one big push failed, and so you were able to have the Church of England take, you know, basically establish roots there. There was also tugs, you know, back and forth throughout history. You get to the English Civil War because what happened is, you know, the Church of England set up their own rules and said you had to do things this way. You had to be, yes, we got free from the Catholics. Now we're going to institute our own law. You know, the Scottish, who are very Presbyterian and Reformed, the English is telling them, no, you got to use the Book of Common Prayer, and if you don't use it, then you're going against the church, and you're going to be disciplined, and we're going to fight, you know, we're going to persecute you. And they're fighting back because they're like, no, we don't want to use the Book of Common Prayer. We have our own liturgy that we want to use. And the Church of England is telling the pastors, well, you have to wear these particular vestments if you're going to preach, and more controversy. So there's constant controversy, and the Puritans, their name derives from the idea that they're trying to purify the church. It's a second Reformation. Maybe not as intense in some ways as the first Reformation, but in many ways, I mean, there's a lot of bloodletting that happens. And so you have the English Civil War, which is essentially Protestants versus the Church of England. And they're fighting for their rights of how to worship. And again, I'm being very general here, but this is where when the Puritans come to America. This is the timeline right here. We're looking at the mid 1620s to the mid 1630s is when the big push of the Puritans went to America. The first group that went to America, of course, was the Pilgrims. You know, that's the on the Mayflower. These are separatists. These are people that said, you know what? We're not even in this battle. We're going to the Netherlands. We're getting out of here. They go to the Netherlands. Eventually, they make their way to America on the Mayflower, you know, Plymouth. These people are also Calvinists. I mean, there's definitely a difference when you get down the nitty-gritty, and as time moves on, the Pilgrims, a lot of the Quakers come out of that, the movement, the Brethren, and then you can even point to, later on, we're going to talk about Universalism, Unitarianism. It came out of that. But the Pilgrims go first around 1620. 1630, you know, the Puritans are people that want to purify the church. So they're staying, they're fighting. When Charles I takes over, Charles I becomes king, he is even more strict. So he takes over, he even starts making friends with Catholics again. He starts instituting things that are a little more Catholic than what it had been. And now the Protestants are like, what's going on here? Like, we're losing ground. What's happening? And this is where the Civil War begins. Eventually, a lot of the Puritans under persecution fled to America. And so this is probably around 1630, I would say. I think that's the date that I have there. So the Massachusetts Bay Colony is established. Puritans sail for New England. Not long after that, a new Archbishop of Canterbury is appointed, William Laud. And he is even more Catholic. So they're killing Puritans at this point. They're persecuting them and killing them. So there's a big migration to the New World. So this is where the Puritans come from. One of the interesting things, and I forgot to write this down, but during the Civil War, around 1642, Parliament, you have Oliver Cromwell, he's ahead of, over the Parliament. They finally, they get the upper hand, they take over, they get Charles out. So the Protestants are winning, and he creates this army of Puritans. And just to give you a sense, so there's definitely issues there. There's some problems with this Puritan army, but it's really interesting to hear what these Puritans are. It's an army formed of Calvinists, is what it is. Like, he really did. Like, it was almost like you need to believe this to be a part of the army. So you had all these men that were coming to fight who believed so hard in the truth of the Bible and the scriptures that they were willing to fight. And so you have this army that would sing psalms as they marched into battle, and it scared the Church of England to death and their enemies to death, because this massive army of men with swords, on horses, were singing psalms and coming after. This is what Puritanism was. I mean, these are some hardcore people here. So Puritan political philosophy, let's get back, we have a little bit of a outline here of what happened on the timeline, but to get back into their politics, it may very well be said that the first product of Puritan theology was a Puritan philosophy of government. It was the clear recognition of the nature of the political conflict in England which induced the leaders of the Exodus to the New World to set up a state which would conform to the dictates of the Puritan theology, and which would be a fitting home for the church which upheld it. That's what they were trying to do when they came to America. It wasn't just escaping. It was creating something new. Puritan political thought is a lasting monument to their appreciation of the scriptures as the whole counsel of God, and their desire to realize in every aspect of their corporate life as well as their individual experiences. The idea that the state was beyond the reach of the claims of the Bible was as abhorrent to the Puritans as were the claims of Rome that the state was subject to the church. So the Puritans are fighting, these errors from both sides, the Catholic error, but also the error that we see today where it says, oh, well, religion can have its own little space over here as long as it doesn't interfere with the important things of government. Well, the Puritans would laugh at that. They thought that's nonsense to them. The Puritan view of government set them apart from the Roman Catholic and Church of England, as well as from the rising group of secularist writers and philosophers who were promoting the social contract, which posits that the law and political order are not natural, but are human inventions. So again, you have these philosophers starting to write, and the Puritans are in the middle here. They're not going in either direction. So basically, the idea of the social contract, and again, generalization, but it's the idea that men voluntarily give up their liberties with specific qualifications for the benefit of social order, enforcement of laws, protection, So if the law is man-made, the idea is that men are sort of agreeing by when you form a community, you're agreeing that you're going to be an authority and you're going to have particular rights to make life worth living, to protect us, and we're going to give up some liberties in order for that to happen. It's a man-made contract. And we'll get into that more next week as we talk about deism and universalism, and eventually as we get into some of the, you know, through history. But the beginning of this was starting now. You know, Locke and Rousseau had a tremendous influence on our founding fathers, but at this point in time, you have men like Thomas Hobbes and Hugo Grotius who were writing. And incidentally, it's not just their ideas of politics that are starting to inform people, but these are hardcore, like Grotius is an Arminian. His views are starting to influence the culture as well. So in Puritan political philosophy, though, it was the sovereign God who created the state and gave to it its powers and functions. The earthly rulers held their offices and exercised what powers they had only by a divine decree. Rulers were ministers of God under common grace for the execution of the laws of God among the people. In order to maintain law and order, and get this, and to provide an atmosphere, so this is the government's job, the ruler's job, to provide an atmosphere favorable for the preaching of the gospel. That's their job. In Puritan political theory, the magistrate derived his powers from God and not from the people. Now, many historians have commented that this type of government was just what I was talking about earlier. So they say it's hypocritical, but again, there was a definite separation. Salvation does not come from the government. The government is to assist the church to maintain order so that the gospel can be preached. Greg Singer says, both, so state and church, were divinely ordained for certain definite purposes. But the purposes were not identical, and the Puritans never confused the two institutions or their respective roles in their society. The state was concerned with the earthly life of the people of God and the unregenerate who might live in their midst. The state is an instrument of common grace, while the church is an instrument of redemptive grace. Later, Singer says, government had no redemptive quality or ability. Its function was to restrain the expression of human sinfulness, but it could neither remove the sin from human nature nor redeem the sinner. And that seems hard to even fathom today, the idea that that's what the government is supposed to be doing, because in many ways our systems are set up almost extreme opposite. They don't believe sin exists, or if there is sin, it's a particular kind of sin that they've invented. So it's the sin, you know, of our, you know, intolerance or, you know, whatever it may be. But then on the other hand, the state believes they are God. You know, you can be saved through welfare system or through whatever the government system is. They believe they are there to save people. So it's this interesting, they almost took both sides. Today what we're seeing is both sides, that sin doesn't really exist. People are inherently good. Oh, and we are also the saviors of mankind, where the Puritans are saying sin matters, and also the government is not our savior. God is in control. Listen to what John Davenport says. He's the Puritan minister, and he was the co-founder of the colony New Haven, which eventually was incorporated into Connecticut. But he says, these two different orders and states, the ecclesiastical order and the civil order, be not set in opposition as contraries that one should destroy the other, but as coordinate states in the same place, reaching forth, help mutually to help each other for the welfare of both according to God, so that both officers and members of churches be subject in respect of the outward man to the civil power of those who bear rule in the civil state according to God and teach others to do so. Sorry, this, I know the language is a little probably hard to follow, but and that the civil magistrates and officers in regard of the inward man subject themselves spiritually to the power of Christ in church ordinances, and by their civil power preserve the same in outward peace and purity. The church and state were to cooperate in the attainment of their respective goals, for they were both subject to the same God. It was for this reason that the state was to punish blasphemers and heretics. Now, they do that today, of course, because they have a different version and view of what blasphemers and heretics are. But that to me is pretty amazing. The state's job was to punish blasphemers and heretics. It was not the state's job to preach the gospel, but it was its duty to establish such civil conditions as to enable the church to perform this function. So the church preaches the gospel. The government's job is to make it so that they can do that. And one of the ways they do that is when there are people out there blaspheming the church or causing dissension, the state steps in and blocks it and puts them, you know, we're not specific about the punishment. Of course, we're going to get into this in a little bit. Sometimes that's where some of the problems with Puritanism happened. But there was a sense where the government is to prevent people from hindering the gospel. This is also why it was necessary, again, hear this. This is why it was necessary that only church members in good standing be allowed to vote. Imagine that. A theologically enlightened electorate was as vitally necessary for the state as a biblically oriented membership was for the church. Orthodoxy of religious belief was therefore a prime requisite for participation in this way of life because theology lay at the very heart of their entire system. So imagine that. Imagine that today. Again, we have similarity. We have sort of the false view of that, of course, because it's getting to the point where if you don't believe certain things, you won't be able, your vote won't matter. You won't have a say in what's happening in government. But this is, you know, sometimes we kind of take this perspective of where we just want to take a step back. And even today, it's sort of like, we can't force people to believe. But that really has played a part in where we are today. The fact that we did not demand and enforce, at least in some fashion or form, that you need to be a, you need to love Jesus, you need to follow God, you need to be attending church. It matters. It shapes who you are. It shapes the country. And again, there's other reasons for this, but the country did not benefit from having non-Christians play a big role in its formation, which eventually is what happened. Let's talk briefly about economics. Like everything else, Puritan economy was informed by the scriptures. There was a strict regulation of economic life in New England. That sounds bad, but again, you know, that doesn't fit with our modern mindset. There was a strict regulation of economic life in New England, which differed from the laissez-faire conceptions later popularized by Adam Smith. John Cotton, the Puritan minister, vigorously denounced the view that man should sell as dear as he can and buy as cheap as he can. So again, the Puritans, contrary to what we think they were based on our popular understanding, were not these uptight, stingy people. They threw parties, they enjoyed life, and they enjoyed the benefit. You know, they ate, drink, and be merry, you know. The right of private property and free enterprise was clearly recognized. But similar to liberty, it was given a biblical setting. The regulation of economic life was not for the purpose of ushering in some kind of man-made utopia or even some humanly achieved millennial period, but for the honoring of the law and glory of God in human affairs. So that's Puritan economics. Now let's talk about the decline of Puritanism. Of course, the Puritans were not always consistent or righteous in their outworking of church and state. Many critics are quick to point out the flaws in Puritanism. And again, I refer back to the Scarlet Letter. That's, you know, that book drips with disdain for Puritans. Naturally, though, the sin, when you point to the criticisms of the Puritan way of life, that doesn't come as a surprise to Puritans, and it doesn't come as a surprise to us as Calvinists. We have the same view of the doctrine of sin as they did. They understood this. This is why they set things up the way they did. But they're still the fact that man is a sinful creature can, you know, that's true. Even if you recognize it, it's still a thing you have to overcome. And the Puritans, you can point to issues there where sin got the best of them. Where, again, when you're talking about government and power, sin plays a role in that. As we'll see in the following weeks, the criticisms is quite hypocritical, the criticisms against Puritanism, because those who point out the sins and abuses of the Puritans do so from a worldview that denies the sinfulness of man. So again, they're very quick to point out sin against the worldviews and the practices of people they don't like. So they're very quick when you have somebody that, you know, for instance, you know, that does something wicked that we would all denounce in the church. You know, a pastor, you know, is, you know, stealing funds from the church or sexual abuse, whatever it may be. You know, everybody, the world is quick to point to that and say, look at these wicked people. But in their own worldview, they don't have a view of sin. They believe that man is inherently good. So they're hypocrites. The system of government that we have today is born out of a philosophy that man is inherently good, that they can achieve perfection or utopia through good works, and that their freedoms are inherent in their existence. Around this time of the Puritans, Descartes wrote, "I think, therefore I am." You know, this idea that who you are is based on the fact that you exist. So not your identity doesn't come from above, but the fact that you are. Well, the progressive takes that, and as we'll see, this is true. This is not just a clever saying. The progressive takes this and says, "I am, therefore I am good." That's political philosophy in a nutshell, as we'll read. Singer says, finally, as we're talking about the downfall or the decline of Puritanism, he says, "In their zeal for maintaining the true religion as a necessary basis for their biblical commonwealth," again, so what he's saying is they were so passionate about their beliefs and trying to create this God-honoring society that they were guilty at times of forgetting that the true union lay in the realm of theology and not on the institutional level. So sometimes the balance went to where they're trying to enforce goodness among the people by the government. And so what happens is you get into these issues of, you know, so for instance, in history, you have the Quakers at this point, and they're around, and their theology is based on this idea of, well, all of us have God inside of us, and you know, we don't really need the preaching and the scriptures as much as you just need to get in touch with, you know, what's inside of you. And so they're coming into the Puritan, and they're talking, and they're spreading, and they're holding Bible studies, and the Puritans are like, "Get out." And then they arrest them, and they're like, "Get out. You know, you're banished from Boston. You're banished from Massachusetts." But these Quakers keep coming back in, so they get banished. At one point, they're sent back to England. Well, they hop on a boat and come right back. And they continually protest to the point where the Puritans are like, "Okay, hang them." You know, which, again, you could argue they crossed a line there. You know, there's a... And it's interesting because I think there's a parallel there to even what's going on in England. You know, under Cromwell, the Protestants took control, and they were winning the battle. And what did they do? They cut off Charles's head, and they killed William Laud, and they started killing the Church of England people. And all of a sudden, it's almost like you do this good thing, you're establishing these... You're making gains, and all of a sudden you kind of go too far, and there's consequences for that. You can see the same thing in Puritans, the way that they handled things. There was also a decline. Again, there's a decline in zeal going into the third and fourth generation. And I forget what the date is, but you have probably in the 1630, the halfway covenant. Basically, the idea is that the church is looking around, they're seeing that the zeal is fading, and the next generations are not as faithful as the previous generations. But what do we do about these baptized babies? Because in order to be baptized, you need to be a member in good standing in the church. Well, we have all these people that were baptized as babies that aren't even coming to church now. So they compromised, and they said, well, if you were baptized in the church, then you can baptize your child in the church. But you just can't benefit from some of the other church benefits. So they were allowing people who were purposely like just rebelling against the church to baptize their children. And then they weren't even coming to church to partake of the benefits of the church, which caused a lot of problems. So there's a lot of people out there, which we look around now in our southern world, you know, there are people that, I'm a Christian. Well, where do you go to church? I don't go to church. Well, what, you know, that's the same situation that happened. The Puritans, in trying to compromise or in trying to look good or in trying to save face, caused more problems. And again, I mentioned this earlier. This is about, again, you think about this time period. We're not far from the Reformation. And so you have the battle with Calvin, and of course you have Arminius, and Arminianism has taken root. And Arminianism eventually was influential in England and had ramifications there. Well, now it's starting to come over into the New World. So you have people coming over into America who are now against Calvinism and are now preaching against Calvinism. So now you're having shakeups there. So if you want to talk about the downfall of Puritanism, these are some things that you can look at, that you can, you know, examine and see that these things happened. But that is essentially the foundation of what we're going to study. Where we come from when we're trying to evaluate the culture comes from this. We are, in essence, children of Puritans, our beliefs, what we hold to. And I think it's a really good foundation to get to understand. That's why this timeline is beneficial. The other paper I sent out, just real quickly, I won't read it. You can look at it later. I don't even know if I have it here. But it's really fascinating to I don't have mine. But John Winthrop was a governor of just real quick. Just read it when you get a chance. Imagine a governor nowadays addressing the court in this manner. It's fascinating. It would not happen today. It's amazing that this was what the Puritan politics was like. It's a beautiful speech given by a governor of a state, a Puritan. So this is Puritan beliefs in action in a political realm. And the other thing that's interesting, I think here I put on the other sheet on the backside of it, 1647, during the English Civil War, that's when the Westminster Confession of Faith was put together. Read what the difference between the 1647 view of what the magistrate's role is. This is the Westminster Confession of Faith. And then, I don't have it with me, but what is the American amendment of the Westminster Confession of Faith in 1789. So 140 years later, in America, we amended the Westminster Confession of Faith on the role of government. Just compare those two things, and you'll see where we're headed. Again, 1789, we're going to be covering that period next week. Look at the difference between what the Puritans and the Presbyterians did in 1647 and what we're looking at in 1789 now. So, but that's it. We're time for snacks and fellowship and setting up. But if there's any questions, feel free to come and talk to me and try to answer them, or at the fellowship meal. I would offer questions now, but we probably need to get going. But thank you for listening and coming.